And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, let me give you a thought to consider. A smile can get you far. But a smile with a gun can get you much further. So saith Al Capone. Well, today is July 31st, 212th day of the year, leap year 213 in the Gregorian calendar. Only 153 days left until the end of this year, and Lord, it can't come soon enough. In 30 BC, the Battle of Alexandria. Mark Antony beats Octavia's forces, but most of his army deserts, leading to his suicide. And shortly thereafter, Cleopatra joined him in suicide. 781, the oldest recorded eruption of Mount Fuji. A traditional Japanese day, it was the sixth day of the seventh month of the first year of the Tenno. In the year 1009, Pope Sergius IV becomes the 142nd Pope, succeeding Pope John the 18th. 1201, attempted usurpation by John Komnenos the Fat for the throne of Alexios III Angelos. 1423, 100 Years War, Battle of Cravant. French army is defeated by the English at Cravant on the banks of the River Yonne. 1451, Jacques Coeur is arrested by the order of Charles VII of France. Now, he was a French merchant, one of the founders of the trade between France and the Levant. Born at Burgess, the city where his father, Pierre Coeur, was a rich merchant. His first turned over around 1418 when he married Massé de Leo de Parte. 1429, he formed a commercial partnership with two brothers named Goddard. 1432, he was in Damascus buying and bartering, transporting the wares of the Levant to the interior of France by way of Narbonne. Well, 1436, he was summoned to Paris by Charles VII, made master of the mint. A very important post. Had very onerous duties. Well, he had loaned money to many, many prominent people, to include members of the royal family and even to the king. And his debtors, who were jealous of his wealth, were eager for a chance to cause his downfall. 1450, Agnes Sorel, the king's mistress, suddenly died. 18 months later, it's rumored she'd been poisoned, and the lady of the court owed money to Jacques Coeur. Her name was Jean de Vendôme. Accused him of having poisoned her. Now, there was no basis for these charges, but you don't need a basis for a charge. No evidence of that. Well, 1492, along with Columbus sailing the ocean blue, the Jews are expelled from Spain. When the Alhambra decree takes place. 1498, on his third voyage to the Western Hemisphere, Christopher Columbus becomes the first European to discover the island of Trinidad. 1588, Spanish Armada spotted off the coast of England. 1618, Maurice, Prince of Orange, disbands the Waardgelders militia in Utrecht, a pivotal event in the counter-Remonstrant tensions. 1655, Russo-Polish War. Russian army enters the capital of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, Vilnius, which it holds for 6 years. The Russo-Polish War, which began in 1654, didn't end until 1667. 1658, Aurangzeb is proclaimed Mughal Emperor of India, 1703. Daniel Defoe, who wrote Robinson Crusoe, is placed in the pillory for the crime of seditious libel after publishing a politically satirical pamphlet, but he is pelted with flowers. 1712, the action of July 31st, 1712, the Great Northern War. Danish and Swedish ships clash in the Baltic Sea. The outcome of this battle was rather inconclusive. 1715, 7 days after a Spanish treasure fleet of 12 ships left Havana, Cuba for Spain, 11 sank in a storm off the coast of Florida. Kip Wagner and his folks salvaged a lot of that treasure. 1741, Charles Albert of Bavaria invades Upper Austria and Bohemia. 1763, Odawa Chief Pontiac's forces defeat British troops at the Battle of Bloody Run during Pontiac's War. 1777, the Second U.S. Continental Congress passes a resolution that the services of Gilbert de Montier, Marquis de Lafayette, be accepted in consideration of his zeal, illustrious family, and connections. He have the rank and commission of Major General of the United States. 1790, first U.S. patents issued to inventor Samuel Hopkins for a potash process. That's used in making a gunpowder. 1856, Christchurch, New Zealand is chartered as a city. 1865, the first narrow gauge mainline railway in the world opens at Grantchester, Queensland, Australia. 1874, Dr. Patrick Francis Healy became the first African American inaugurated as president of a predominantly white university. That was Georgetown University. 1904, the Russo-Japanese War, Battle of Hsmuchten. Units of the Imperial Japanese Army defeat units of the Imperial Russian Army in a strategic confrontation. 1913, the Balkan States sign an armistice in Bucharest. 1917, World War I. The Battle of Passchendaele begins near Ypres in western Flanders in Belgium. 1932, the NSDAP, that's the Nazi Party, wins more than 38% of the vote in German elections. 1938, Bulgaria signs a non-aggression pact with Greece and other states of Balkan Entente. That's Turkey, Romania, and Yugoslavia. 1938, archaeologists discover engraved gold and silver plates from King Darius the Great in Persepolis. 1941, under instructions from Adolf Hitler, Nazi official Hermann Göring orders SS General Reinhard Heydrich to submit to me as soon as possible a general plan for the administrative material and financial measures necessary for carrying out the desired final solution of the Jewish question. This set the ground for the Holocaust. 1941, World War II, Smolensk concludes with Germany capturing about 300,000 Soviet Red Army prisoners. 1945, Pierre Laval, the fugitive former leader of Vichy France, surrenders to Allied soldiers in Austria. 1948, at Idlewild Field, New York, New York International Airport, which was later renamed John F. Kennedy International Airport, is dedicated. 1948, USS Nevada sunk by aerial torpedo after surviving hits from two atomic bombs as part of post-war test and being used for target practice by three other ships. 1964, the Ranger program. Ranger 7 sends back the first close-up photos of the moon with images 1,000 times clearer than anything ever seen from Earth-bound telescopes. 1970, Black Tot Day, the last day of the officially sanctioned rum ration in the Royal Navy. They used to periodically hand out rum to sailors. And they were called rum tots. 1971, the Apollo program. Apollo 15 astronauts become the first to ride in a lunar rover. 1972, the Troubles. In Operation Motorman, the British Army retakes the urban no-go areas of Northern Ireland. The biggest British military operation since the Suez Crisis in 1956, and the biggest in Ireland since the Irish War of Independence. Later that same day, July 31st, 1972, nine civilians are killed by car bombs in the city of Cloudy. 1973, a Delta Airlines jetliner, flight DL-723, crashes while landing in fog at Logan International Airport in Boston. 89 are killed. 1975, the Troubles once again. Three members of a popular cavalry band and two gunmen are killed during a botched paramilitary attack in Northern Ireland. 1987, tornado occurs in Edmonton, Canada. 1988, 32 people are killed and 1,674 injured when a bridge at the Sultan Abdul Halim ferry terminal collapses in Butterworth, Penang, Malaysia. 1991, the U.S. and the Soviet Union both signed the START 1 Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. That's the first to reduce, with verification, both countries' nuclear stockpiles. 1992, the nation of Georgia joins the United Nations. Also, 1992, Thai Airways International Flight 311 crashes into a mountain north of Kathmandu, Nepal. Kills all 113 people on board. 1999, Discovery Program, Lunar Prospector. NASA intentionally crashes a spacecraft into the moon, thus ending its mission to detect frozen water on the moon's surface. And it was found. 2006, Fidel Castro hands over power to his brother Raul. 2007, Operation Banner, the presence of the British Army in Northern Ireland and the longest-running British Army operation ever, comes to an end. 2008, East Coast Jets, Flight 81 crashes near Owatonna, Degna Regional Airport in Owatonna, Minnesota. All eight people on board are killed. 2012, Michael Phelps breaks the record set in 1964 by the Rissa Latinina for the most medals won at the Olympics. 2014, gas explosions in the southern Taiwanese city of Kaohsiung kill at least 20 people and injure more than 270. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays. Christian Feast Day. Abanub, Germanus of Auxerre, Ignatius of Loyola, New York. Earliest day on which the Feast of Kamal can fall. August 1st is the latest. Observed on the first day of the 8th month of the Bahia calendar. End of the Trinity term. Sitting of the High Court of Justice in England. Kahaewae Day in Hawaii and its related observance. Sovereignty Restoration Day in the Hawaiian Sovereignty Movement. Martyrdom Day of Shahid Udham Singh in India. Treasury Day in Poland. Warriors Day in Malaysia. Now let's see what else we got. In 1620, the Pilgrim Fathers depart Leiden, Netherlands for England on their way to America. 1961, Israel welcomes its 1 millionth immigrant. 1912, the U.S. government prohibits movies and photos of prize fights. And let's see what else. All righty. Well, I'm having a little internet trouble here, don't you know? It's National Avocado Day in the U.S. National Tree Day in Australia. Alrighty, let's see what else we might have here. On this day in 1998, the British government bans landmines. 1981, the first female president of the U.S. National Bar Association is appointed. 768, Philip begins and ends his reign as Catholic Pope. In 1291, Egyptian Mamelukan occupies Akko. Crusaders are driven out of Palestine. Now, 1737, Prince Frederick of Wales escapes English court. 1741, Charles Albert of Bavaria invades Austria and Bohemia. 1751, a fire in Stockholm destroys 1,000 houses. 1802, and I made mention of the Marquis de Lafayette. He made a major general in the Continental Army. I might also point out he's only 19 years old at the time. In 1792, the cornerstone is laid for the first U.S. government building, the U.S. Mint in Philadelphia. Okay, what else we got? 1864, U.S. Grant's named General of Volunteers. His detractors accused him of being a drunk. 1900, Boer generals Prince Lu and Ru surrender in Brandwater Basin. 1914, German Emperor Wilhelm II threatens to go to war and orders Russia to demobilize. 1914, oil is discovered in Lake Maracaibo. 1919, the Weimar Constitution goes into effect, establishing the German Republic. 1920, 1948, Brigadoon. That classic. Closes at the Ziegfeld Theater in New York City after 581 performances. Well, I think that's pretty much the high points. Oh, one last thing. 1966. Alabamans burn Beatle products due to John Lennon's anti-Jesus remark. Lennon never knew when to keep his mouth shut. All right. We were talking about the stories behind some of the longest recorded prison sentences in modern history. This next one took place in England. His name was John Straffan. Over the course of 3 weeks in July and August of 1951, the 21-year-old strangled two girls, ages 6 and 9, in Bath, England. Now, he'd been in and out of trouble and, frankly, in and out of institutions for the mentally defective since he was 10. But, unfortunately, the powers that be allowed him to move about on his own at the time he killed the girls. Now, once again, he was deemed unfit for trial and sent to a high-security asylum for a term to be determined by a psychiatrist. In 1952, he escaped the asylum by climbing over a fence. Well, his escape was noted, and they started looking for him, and it only took him 4 hours to recapture him. But in that 4 hours, he managed to strangle the third girl. This one was 5 years old. Now, Straffan was tried, convicted, and sentenced to die for the three murders. But a British official who remained anonymous recommended to Queen Elizabeth II she give Straffan, who was clearly mentally ill, a reprieve from the death penalty. Queen agreed, and Straffan's sentence became life with no chance of parole. He died November 19, 2007, at the age of 77. He had served 55 years in prison. Unfortunately, his three victims died. Nobody stopped to think about the heinousness of the crime. They thought about the poor criminal. Well, under the category of everybody got to make a living, there are certain crime-related collectibles that seem to sell routinely. I'm talking about fingernails and a cut-up Christmas card from a convicted murderer. Now, Southern California isn't all palm trees and sunshine. It's also the stomping ground for 10% of the world's known serial killers during the 20th century. Among these serial killers was Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris, who met in prison in San Luis Obispo in the 70s, and after their release, bought a windowless van that they nicknamed Murder Mac. During the summer of 1979, they cruised beaches, photographing and picking up girls, and they raped and murdered at least 5 of the girls they picked up. Norris eventually testified against Bittaker for a sentence of 45 years to life, and Bittaker got the death penalty. In the 1970s, collectors began to look for what was called murderabilia, souvenirs from heinous crimes and killers. Bittaker sold his prison-issued socks, but Norris hoped he'd really be able to cash in. While imprisoned, he clipped his fingernails and taped them to a piece of a cut-up Christmas card. And he authenticated the card with a long handwritten note, his signature and his fingerprint. Well, it's unclear who or how many people the card belonged to over the years, but it turned up on eBay in 1999. When the auction opened, There was one bid. $9.99. And apparently it won. Well, sometimes far-sighted entrepreneurs turn a profit on other people's crimes. In 1974, a man named Ronald DeFeo murdered his parents and four siblings as they slept in their home in Amityville, New York. He was convicted of the crimes and sentenced to six consecutive life sentences in prison. The murder house, as it was called, sold for a song to a struggling couple named George and Kathy Lutz, and they moved into the house a week before Christmas in 1975. 28 days later, they moved out in the middle of the night, claiming the house was haunted and the evil spirits that had driven them away were probably what caused DeFeo to murder his entire family. Their story inspired the best-selling 1977 book, The Amityville Horror, and then the hit film that premiered in 1979. Well, in 1979, Ronald DeFeo's defense attorney, William Weber, filed a lawsuit against the Lutzes, accusing them of fraud and breach of contract. He said they reneged on an agreement to collaborate with Weber on the book. So where'd the haunted house story come from? Well, in an interview with Associated Press, Weber admitted he and the Lutzes concocted the horror story scam over a lot of bottles of wine. So was it true or not? Well, we just don't know. Well, let's talk about the man that's known as the Bigfoot of crime. Hijacked an airplane, stole a small fortune, parachuted out of sight, and went into legend. 1971, a man wearing a plain dark suit, white shirt, dark tie, and sunglasses approached the Northwest Orient Airlines ticket counter in Portland, Oregon. Paid $20 in cash for a one-way ticket to Seattle on Flight 305. Once the 727 was airborne, the man summoned the flight attendant, introduced himself as Dan Cooper, and handed her a note. Said he had a bomb in his briefcase, and he's going to blow up the plane if they didn't meet his demands. He wanted two parachutes and $200,000 in used $20 bills, non-sequentially numbered. When the plane landed, Cooper kept the pilot and the crew hostage, but let the passengers get off in exchange for the ransom. Then he ordered the pilot to take off from Mexico with very specific instructions. Keep the landing gear down and the flight speed under 170 miles per hour. 25 miles northeast of Portland, Cooper strapped on a parachute, tied the money to his waist, and jumped out of the plane. See, in those days, this particular version of the 727 had a stairway that could be lowered. You could actually exit the plane through the rear. In the ensuing investigation, the police questioned a man named Daniel B. Cooper. Now, he was not a serious suspect, but the FBI reported that interrogated D.B. Cooper, and those initials became forever linked with the skyjacker. The FBI manhunt that followed was unprecedented in scope and in intensity. Every inch of ground in the vicinity of the purported landing site was searched for over 18 days. It was a humbling moment when, after weeks of tracking down leads, the FBI admitted they hadn't found anything. It was a complete dead end. One frustrated FBI agent referred to Cooper as the Bigfoot of crime because there was no proof of his existence anywhere. If he survived, he had actually pulled off the crime of the century. Well, the hijacking caught the media's attention. Reports raved about the audacity of the crime and the calm, competent way that Cooper carried it out. According to flight attendants, Cooper was polite throughout the ordeal, even requesting that meals be delivered to the crew while they were in Seattle. That was while they were on the ground waiting for the ransom money to be delivered. Well, to the little people everywhere, he was a folk hero, a modern-day Jesse James. A number of books, mostly written by former FBI agents, provided theories about what happened to him. He was possibly living the high life on a beach in Mexico, or he'd slipped back into his former life somewhere in the U.S. undetected and unnoticed. Well, February 13th, 1980, the first evidence of D.B. Cooper came to light. A family picnicking on the Columbia River, 30 miles west of Cooper's landing area, found three bundles of disintegrating $20 bills. Those three bundles amounted to $5,800. The serial numbers were traced to the ransom, but the rest of the cash and the man behind the legend were never found. Well, you know, not every 911 call is a earth-shaking event. Sometimes you get false alarms. 1999, a 911 dispatcher in Arkansas, of all places, got a call. But there was nobody on the line. All she could hear was a football game. So she hung up and called the number back, but nobody answered. Short time later, she got another call. And then another call. But there was nobody on the line. She could hear that football game. A few minutes later, it happened again, and then it happened again, and it happened again. In fact, all in all, the dispatchers got 35 calls before police could finally trace who was doing the calling. It was a football fan who had his cell phone set to speed dial 911. It was in his pocket, and it dialed every time he stood up to cheer. Maybe he was unhappy his team wasn't winning. Well, in 2005, 86-year-old Dorothy Densmore of Charlotte, North Carolina, called 911, complained that a nearby pizza shop refused to deliver pizza to her. Dispatcher advised her that calling 911 for non-emergencies was a crime and hung up on her. Well, Densmore called back and kept calling back, reiterating her complaint. In fact, she called the 911 operator more than 20 times that night. An officer was sent out to her house to arrest her, but when she found out why he was there, oh, she went berserk. She kicked him, she punched him, and she bit him on the hand. She also complained to the dispatcher somebody in the pizza parlor called her a crazy old coot. Well, I think by the time it was all over, the officer would agree she was a crazy old coot. Well, nobody ever said would-be criminals were geniuses. Here's a story of a man who, for lack of a better term, blew it. A Warmsburg man burned himself and is facing criminal charges after he used a lighter to check on his effort to steal gasoline from a dump truck. Gasoline caught on fire and destroyed a forklift. Glenn Germain, 19, suffered minor burns in the blaze when he lit a lighter to see how full the gas can he was filling up had become. The lighter ignited gas on his hands and in the can, and the gas can fire spread to the forklift, destroying the vehicle completely. Germain later admitted he was responsible for the fire. He told investigators he was just trying to see the progress of the siphoning process. He was shocked he was arrested. Well, a couple rushing to make a high school graduation ceremony led police on a high-speed chase that ended when they sped through a train crossing and crashed into a nearby house. Amazingly, no one was hurt. Turns out the wrecked car was going to be a surprise present for the graduate they were going to see. Well, a five-time burglar from Detroit found himself back in the can, so to speak, charged with another burglary. But the way they caught him was kind of interesting. He played with some silly putty at the house he had just robbed and left his fingerprints in the silly putty. Well, let's talk about one of Brazil's most notorious unsolved serial killings. Seems 13 gay men between the ages of 20 and 50 were murdered in Paturas Park in the Brazilian city of Carapicuba. It's near Sao Paulo. Between July 2007 and August 2008, 12 were shot and one was beaten to death. In a neighboring community of Sasco, three other gay men were murdered, and police believe they may be victims of the same killer. The killer was dubbed the Rainbow Maniac in reference to the rainbow symbol of gay pride because all the victims are believed to have been gay. 4 months after the 13th murder, police announced they arrested Hario Francisco Franco, a retired Sao Paulo police officer. He was arrested after a witness told him they had seen Franco commit one of the murders on August 19, 2008. Another witness came forward and told police that Franco regularly visited the park seeking gay men. Well, shortly after Franco's arrest, Police Inspector Paulo Fortunato told reporters, "We're convinced he's the rainbow maniac we've been looking for." Well, when Franco went to trial in August of 2011, he was found not guilty by a jury in a 4-2 decision. Well, undercover agents still patrolled that park at night, and the identity of the rainbow maniac still remains unknown. Well, if we watch a lot of shows on TV about crime solving, we always hear about DNA and forensic science. So let's talk about when and how DNA became a part of forensic science. Well, in 1986, Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld were sent a case file regarding a man who was in New York prison. Scheck and Neufeld had attended law school in the late 60s and were steeped in the social justice movement that defined the era. As young lawyers in the 70s, they cut their teeth as public defenders in the South Bronx, where they had worked on the most desperate cases, similar to the one they had just been handed. You see, Marion Coakley, who was 30, had been convicted of a violent robbery, kidnapping, and rape that had taken place in a Bronx hotel in 1983. The victim described her attacker as a dark-skinned black man with a Jamaican accent and a short afro. She later picked Coakley, who was a light-skinned black man with no Jamaican accent and no afro, out of a lineup. 17 people, including a priest, said they were with Coakley at a church meeting miles from the scene of the crime at the time it occurred. Well, in spite of his alibi witnesses, he was convicted anyway. Well, Scheck and Neufeld agreed to look into the case. A blood expert they worked with by the name of Robert Shaler told them this was a good case to test out an emerging technology called DNA testing. Now, that DNA could be used to identify individuals had been discovered only a few years before, and it had never been used in a criminal case in the U.S. This case would be the first time it was used in this country. At the same time they were looking into doing it, was being used for the first time in a case in England. Well, Scheck and Neufeld tried to use DNA testing to get Coakley's conviction overturned. It didn't work. Not enough DNA could be extracted from the evidence to identify the attacker. Well, fortunately, they were able to get Coakley's conviction overturned by proving his innocence and based on other evidence, including a bloody palm print on the rearview mirror of the victim's car. After serving 2 years in prison, Coakley was released. Well, though the use of DNA technology hadn't been successful in this case, Scheck and Neufeld knew that it was a game changer. For the next couple of years, both law enforcement and science worked to figure out how DNA testing was going to fit into the world of forensics. Now, fingerprinting had taken decades to be integrated into forensic science. If DNA testing was going to be accepted, it'd have to be understandable to investigators, judges, and juries. And Scheck and Neufeld became closely involved with this process. They're credited with integrating DNA testing as a standard part of forensics, quickly and thoroughly. In 1992, they went on to found the Innocence Project, an organization that provides legal representation of wrongfully convicted people. You have to know somebody to get them involved. Well, let's look at some more quotes from the world's most famous lawyers. According to John Sterling, the ideal client is a very wealthy man in very great trouble. Yeah, we seem to be having issues here. There we go. Okay, let's talk about some more quotes from the world's most famous lawyers. According to Melvin Belli, he wasn't an ambulance chaser. He was usually there before the ambulance arrived. According to William Kunstler, in New York, there's no law against being annoying. Alan Dershowitz said, the court of last resort is no longer the Supreme Court, it's Nightline. Man, let's talk about David Zapp. He said the adversary system is based on the notion if one side overstates his idea of the truth and the other side overstates his idea of the truth, then the truth will come out. Why can't we just all tell the truth to begin with? Because truth is in the eye of the beholder. And finally, Roy Cohen may have said, I bring out the worst of my enemies, and that's how I get them to defeat themselves. Well, have you ever heard the phrase, having money to burn? Well, destroying currency is a crime. And destroying 1 million pounds, approximately 1.35 million U.S. dollars, in the name of art, is a very strange crime. So why would somebody burn that much cash? If you don't want it, just go spend it. Well, don't ask Bill Drummond or Jimmy Cauty, two former pop stars turned performance artists who pulled that stunt in 1994. They're still not sure why they did it. These two individuals, known as the K Foundation, decided to burn their profits from their defunct music career in the name of art. So a year later, they released a film entitled Watch the K Foundation Burn $1 Million. And it consisted of 67 minutes of the artist tossing 50-pound notes into a fire. And after each screening, there'd be a question and answer session in which Drummond and Cauty would ask the audience questions. Well, the tour got mixed reviews, apparently wantonly destroying cash, thus tend to annoy a lot of people. Despite recording their strange crime, the men were never charged, and they still can't sum up their exact motivation. According to Drummond, I wish I could explain why I did it so people would understand. And it is a hard one to explain to your kids. And over time, it doesn't get any easier. Well, if I watched my parents burning $1 million on a video, I think I would have some very pointed questions to ask. Well, police in the Eastern European country of Moldova reported in 2005 they were on the lookout for a robber who hypnotized bank tellers. The hypno thief was identified as 49-year-old Vladimir Kozak, a trained hypnotist born in Russia. According to police, Kozak would start a conversation with a teller, make eye contact, and put the teller into a hypnotic trance. You'd then have the teller hand over all the money in their cash drawer. Well, Kozak's total haul was nearly $40,000. In fact, one clerk in the city of Sisinal reportedly handed over more than $12,000 in cash. Police put wanted posters of Kozak's face around the nation, with a warning in large letters warning bank clerks not to make eye contact with the man, or with the posters for that matter. Well, according to amateur filmmaker Mark Twitchell's Facebook profile, Mark has way too much in common with Dexter Morgan. Well, you might ask yourself, who's Dexter Morgan? Well, he's the fictional lead character on the television show Dexter, about a crime scene investigator, Michael C. Hall, who moonlights as a vigilante who traps and murders rapists and serial killers. Well, in November of 2008, Twitchell of Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, turned one of Dexter's plots into a real-life nightmare. He answered an online personal ad pretending to be a young woman, and he lured 38-year-old Johnny Altinger to his house. Except Altinger wasn't a serial killer. He was just a man looking for a date. Now, his body was never found, but police identified enough evidence in Twitchell's garage, including a script to a show that detailed his plot, to charge him with first-degree murder. Well, even though the body was never found and there were no witnesses and all the evidence was circumstantial, Twitchell was sentenced to life in prison. Man, doesn't it just burn you up when things don't go according to plan? Let's talk about a cold case that grabbed national attention, not once, but twice. When the Westfield, New Jersey Police Department got a call to check out the List family Victorian mansion on Hillside Avenue, they thought it was going to be just a routine phone call. The Lists, of course, were away visiting a sick relative, as far as anybody knew, but neighbors and friends had grown concerned nonetheless. For over a month, there'd been no communication from anybody in the family. And even though all the lights were on in the house, there was no obvious sign of people there. But when the police entered the residence through an unlocked window, they made a bizarre discovery. Inside the cold mansion, and it was cold, let me tell you, loud organ music played over an intercom system. Officers went out into the mansion's vast ballroom, and they discovered four bodies. The victims were Helen List, the mother, and her three teenage children, Patty, John Jr., and Frederick. Upstairs, Helen's mother-in-law, Alma List, was found dead in her apartment, her attic apartment, but the man of the house, John List, was nowhere to be found. Though the police and the FBI immediately set up an intensive search for John List, 1 week after the bodies were discovered, the authorities admitted that the trail was cold. They didn't have any clues. Having told everybody the family is leaving town, List delayed the discovery of the body for over 28 days. Though police didn't know it, List had moved to Denver and established a new identity with a phony Social Security number and taken the name of Robert P. Clark. Well, in 1989, 18 years later, America's Most Wanted television show decided to run an episode that featured the List case. Problem, from their point of view, was figuring out what List might look like after 20 years. So they turned to forensic sculptor Frank Bender and asked him to make an age progression bust of 64-year-old John List. And that bust was shown on America's Most Wanted. Well, after the show was over, friends of a man by the name of Bob Clark were astounded to see how much he resembled the murderer from New Jersey. And the show brought in a tip that Bob Clark had moved from Colorado to Virginia. Well, List was caught and extradited to New Jersey for trial. A jury found him guilty and sentenced him to life in prison. Well, in a mysterious act of suspected arson, the List home had burned down 9 months after the murders. The fire that demolished the house also destroyed the ballroom's Tiffany stained glass ceiling. A signed original was worth at least $100,000 in 1971. Ironically, had Bliss understood how much that was worth, he could have sold that ceiling, kept his house, solved his financial problems with cash left over to put in the bank, and he wouldn't have had to kill everybody. Sometimes what you don't know can hurt you. Well, let's talk about a classic close call. After a domestic violence conviction in April of 2009, Donald Sexton was ordered to stay with his wife Tammy for 6 months. But a week into the restraining order, he went to her rural Mississippi home in the middle of the night, planning on murdering her. As Tammy Sexton lay in bed, Donald came into her room, shot her in the head, went outside, and shot himself. Well, he died instantly. Tammy, though, didn't. When police arrived, she was conscious, had a rag around her head, was drinking a cup of tea. Medical examination at the University of Alabama revealed that the .38 caliber bullet that had entered her forehead and exited through the back of her head, passing through the lobes of her brain without leaving any damage whatsoever. The sheriff investigating the case, whose name was Mike Byrd, expressed his own amazement at the unlikeliness of such an occurrence. "You just don't hear something like this," he said. "Somebody gets shot in the head and normally they're dead. But she's having a cup of tea." Well, if you've ever read the newspaper, sometimes the folks who write the headlines ought to be arrested themselves. Let me give you some examples. Juvenile court to try a shooting defendant. Why would the juvenile court want to shoot him? Next one. Man robs and then kills himself. He really didn't like himself, I guess. New Jersey judge to rule on nude beach. My goodness. Mayor says D.C. is safe except for all the murders. Man shot twice in the head, gets mad. Deadline passes for striking police. Well, how about this one? Cockroach slain. Husband badly hurt. Those cockroaches can be dangerous, don't you know? Or, man shoots neighbor with machete. I didn't know machetes could shoot. .32 ignorant enough to serve on North jury. Gotta have some ignorant people. It goes with the ignorance demonstrated quite often by the prosecution. Hostage taker kill self. Police shoot each other. Well, like they said on Police Academy, he wanted to be involved in the shooting and he was just devastated when he couldn't be. Potential witness to murder drunk. Okay. Or prosecutor releases probe into the undersheriff. How about bomb hit by library? Robber holds up Albert's hosiery. Albert can't hold up his own hosiery. Multiple personality rapist sentenced to 2 life terms. Well, each personality is entitled to its own conviction, don't you know? Stolen painting found by tree. Well, trees are good for a lot. Man struck by lightning faces battery charges. How about man found dead in cemetery? You know, quite often with most cemeteries, there's people just dying to get in there. Bar trying to help alcoholic lawyers. Defendant speech ends in long sentence. Now, sometimes headlines just really don't make any sense. 42% of all murdered women are killed by the same man. Man, he must get around. Silent teamster gets cruel punishment. Lawyer. Or how about crack found in man's buttocks? Well, most people have cracks in their buttocks. Especially plumbers. Two convicts evade the noose. Jury hung. Well, you know, sometimes crimes are just dumb. A man walks into a gas station with a knife and demands the attendant give him all the money in the cash register. The attendant replied that the guy had to buy something before she could open the register. The robber told her he didn't have any money, so he couldn't buy anything. And the attendant said, well, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. I've got to follow the rules. So the criminal left without taking anything. I guess he's going to go steal some money so he could come back and buy something, and then she could open the drawer. Well, while robbing a bank, the would-be thief fell head over heels in love with the teller he was robbing. And he got away. But he was so smitten, he actually called her at the bank to ask for a date. Well, she talked to him, but she didn't make a date. She kept him on the line long enough for the police to trace the call. Well, in Long Beach, California, several employees of a large aerospace company got the bright idea to rob a bank on their lunch hour. They had everything planned out except for one thing. They forgot to remove their company ID tags while they were robbing the bank. Hello, my name is whatever. Well, one night in 2007, Damon Arbogast cited Deja Vu, a gentleman's club in Nashville, Tennessee, and he lavishly tipped the dancers. The manager grew suspicious after a while and called police, who discovered the money he was handing out was fake. He downloaded an image of a $100 bill and printed out a stack of it on his home laser printer. The dancers were happy. Well, Russian Tsar Ivan the Terrible died in 1584. Historians believe he was a victim of poisoning. The youngest son, Dmitry Ivanovich, disappeared. Three men came forward in 1605, all claiming to be Dmitry and claiming a right to the throne. Gregory Otrepiev was determined to be the real one and ruled as Tsar from July 1605 until he was murdered in May of 1606. Not because he was a fraud, which was actually discovered later on, but because people believed he was the son of Ivan the Terrible. Well, with all that said, we come to the end of another show and the end of this week. We'll be back on Monday when, once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a great weekend.